This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Coming up, we'll hear from Gary Franks, the first black Republican elected to U.S. Congress in nearly 60 years when he took office back in 1991. Since his political career ended in the late 1990s, Franks hasn't been heard from in Connecticut, but now he's got a new book, and we'll talk about his plans to get more African Americans involved in the political system as Republicans. But first, two opposing views of the nuclear deal with Iran. Major General Mike Jones, former Director of Operations and Chief of Staff for the U.S. Central Command, has strong reservations about the scope of the inspections into the Iran nuclear program that were laid out in this deal. Truman National Security Fellow Amir Hanjani, an Iranian-American businessman and Middle East expert, says the plan creates a framework for ending Iran's nuclear threat while acknowledging the increasingly Western focus of the Iranian people. The two were in Hartford debating this issue at two programs put together by the World Affairs Council of Connecticut and Central Connecticut State University. In between these programs, they came to our studios. Major General Mike Jones and Amir Hanjani, welcome to Where We Live. Thanks for being here.
No, thank you. Great to be with you.
Nice to be with you.
You were both here for a conversation with the World Affairs Council about the Iran nuclear deal. It was moderated by our friend Ned Lamont, and I assume we're going to talk through some of the same things that you talked about with him. But I guess I'd like to just start with you, Major General, and ask what you think this deal does for America, what you think this deal does for Iran.
Well, I think that, frankly, for America, it offers us an assurance of something that is insufficient to actually happen, and that is it gives us an assurance that Iran will not actually develop a nuclear weapon, but without the things in place that actually prevent it from occurring. In terms of Iran, I think what it gives them is it obviously gives them a significant amount of capital that will be available to them, and it also allows them to continue whatever kind of covert program that they might have or might start, but without actual interference by the international community.
What are those things that would need to be in place for this deal to have worked better in your mind?
Just a couple things. It really revolves around the inspection regime, and that is we really don't know totally what the Iranians will declare. But having the IAEA have freedom of movement throughout the entire country without being inhibited or instructed in any way is something that should be in the agreement. And then the second thing is if there is some reason to think that there might be some cheating on the agreement or some kind of activity that's suspicious, that the IAEA can then go to that site and watch what's coming and going to make sure that in the adjudication process, the Iranians don't have the opportunity to take material or things out of it. And then the third thing is just an adjudication process that gets to a conclusion much sooner than the 24 days that could be required for the process that's in the agreement. And I think those key things, were they in place, would make this a much more palatable agreement that's not without risk, but is with enough assurity that people could be comfortable with the level of risk of an agreement.
Do you think that these things that are things that actually could have been negotiated into an agreement, do you think that these are things that the Iranian government would have agreed to?
Oh, well, certainly I think that we could have done a much better job in the negotiation process to get what really are not that intrusive kind of arrangements if, in fact, the Iranians are sincere in wanting an agreement.
Amir, I'd like to go to you on this and ask you what you think this agreement means for the U.S. and what it means for Iran.
Well, first of all, I think that both the general and I share a concern, and we both don't want Iran to have a nuclear weapon. I think that's what all Americans don't want to have happen. I think this agreement goes a long way to achieve that goal in a diplomatic and peaceful fashion. It guts Iran's nuclear program in whole and at times in parts. They go down in the level of centrifuges 68%. They go from 19,000 to 6,000. They have 10,000 kilograms of highly enriched uranium. 97% of that is going to be shipped out of the country. It puts in place the most intrusive IAEA inspection regime in history of any country. Is it a perfect deal? No, it's not a perfect deal. That's the unicorn out there because any deal would have to be agreed to by the Iranians. And there are certain aspects of what the general proposes the Iranians would never agree to.
He says essentially it's not intrusive enough. You say it's the most intrusive ever. So there's a clear difference.
I don't just say that. 100 of the world's leading nuclear scientists and nonproliferation experts say that. Many former secretaries of state and national security advisors, both of the Democratic and Republican Party, have said that. So it's a deal that in many ways deals with the threat of a possible Iran with a nuclear weapon and guts that possibility for the next 15 years and in some ways forever in perpetuity. They are signed up for the additional protocol, the IAEA additional protocol, and that stays forever. So if there is ever a suspicion that they are sneaking out, creeping out to develop a weapon, then the IAEA can demand access to that site and Iran would have to give it. If they don't, they'd be in breach of the agreement.
One of the first things the general said, and I've heard this from other critics of the deal, is that this also, because of the lifting of these sanctions, provides an enormous influx of cash to Iran. In some ways, and I want to talk a bit about business dealings with Iran and about the Iranian people, but many in America say what that means is that's money that can be used for terrorist activity, that, mm-hmm. that can be used for something that will end up coming back and hurting America, even if it's not a nuclear weapon.
Mm-hmm. Well, numbers vary between 50 and 100, 150 billion, how much money is going to go back into Iran. But the Iranian economy is decimated. I mean, they need $500 billion invested in their oil and gas sector alone just to come to levels of production they were at 10 years ago. The Rouhani administration has made all sorts of promises for better infrastructure, better education, healthcare reform. That all takes money. You know, $150 billion doesn't rebuild an economy overnight. Iran is a big country. It's twice the size of Texas. It has 80 million people. And a great majority of those people live at or below the poverty line right now. As far as Iran's ability to conduct nefarious activity, that's very low cost for them. They're doing that now without the $150 billion. That pool of money comes out of a different pot. And we shouldn't expect all of this money to go into that type of behavior when they have so much domestic needs and demand at home.
It's, in many ways, General, a strong argument that a country that's more stable, that has more people potentially above the poverty line, fewer people in crisis, that has an economy that can compete internationally, that this may indeed be a country that is more stable and less likely to have terrorists working within it or wanting to come to it. Is that fair?
I think that's fair, and I would say that is correct to some degree, and that is the more dictatorial and brutal a regime is, then clearly the more stable the country is. Democracy is a very messy business, and so I understand that. However, that is not a recipe for eliminating terrorist activity. If you just look at everything starting with the Marine barracks bombing in 83, Khobar Towers, killing of the prime minister in Lebanon, and on and on. I mean, you can go through all kinds of terrorist activity that's been sponsored by the Iranians, both against us, also other folks in the region. So the argument that says, well, because we have a stable regime, it's going to lessen their sponsorship of terrorism, I don't think is a logical argument to me.
You don't see a movement within the Iranian government right now, within this new leadership, within the populace there, a movement away from some of these actions of the past?
Frankly, during the negotiating process, I've been looking very hard to try to look for a change in behavior because, to tell you the truth, changes in behavior tell me the direction a country's going in much more than what they say. During the negotiating period, if you look at their activity, whether it's in Lebanon, Syria, Yemen, where they helped to overthrow the government in Yemen and so forth, I mean, the bottom line is I don't see a change in behavior that would tell me that there's been a strategic change in the direction of the Iranian government.
What do you say to that, America? I think that's one of the questions that a lot of Americans have. If they have to, in essence, trust Iran and the Iranian government to comply with this new world and actually denounce terrorism moving forward, they do need to see it on the ground. Do you see signs that Iran is moving in the right direction?
Well, the general was, I think, painting with a very broad brush. I think absolutely in the 80s and 90s, we found ourselves opposed to Iran on a vast variety of theaters in the region. But today, who are Iran's enemies? Who is an existential threat to Iran? It's ISIS. They happen to be our enemy too. Who is Iran preoccupied right now with fighting in Iraq and Syria? It's ISIS. It's Jabhat al-Nusra. It's al-Qaeda. Yemen, for whatever reason in this country, it's become a manufactured consent, if you will, that to say that the Houthis are a terrorist organization and they overthrew the democratically elected government in Yemen. It was never thus. The Houthis represent 40% of the population in Yemen. The Yemeni president that was installed in Yemen was installed by the Saudis. And when was the last time the Saudis did anything that benefited U.S. interests? Al-Qaeda, ISIS, the Taliban, they're all spawned by Saudi Arabia propaganda and Saudi oil money going abroad. So how we viewed the region in the 80s and 90s as Iran conducting terrorist activity doesn't really apply in 2015 when the region has changed so much and our Iran's enemies in the region happen also to be our enemies in the region.
So what do we do about that, about our enemies and Iran's enemies being the same, General?
Let me go back and correct something because I think I may have misconstrued something, and that is I'm not saying that all the activities of the Iranian government in the region are about terrorism. Actually, I think that they are doing a very crafty job of participating in what is currently known as hybrid warfare, and that is the combination of terrorism, unconventional warfare, other kinds of activities that help them gain their strategic aims. So the fact that they are conducting this kind of behavior in the region, I think, is clearly evident. And again, I don't think there's a diminishment of their activity during the period, even of the negotiation period, when you would have thought that if there was an inkling of a change in the direction of the government, that they'd be likely to make it evident.
Is the threat from ISIS really part of the Sunni-Shia conflict that we've seen played out all across this region? Or is ISIS and its ability to exert its influence elsewhere in the world, is it something different? And is it something that indeed maybe people who have not been friends in the past can be friends over in an attempt to stop them? Because it just seems as though ISIS is a different type of threat than just what has been spawned out of Sunni-Shia conflict in the region.
Well, I think you have a matter of degree, and that is, you have in the range of engagement, you have competition, you have conflict, you have war, and so forth. So it's a matter of extremes. Is it part of this larger Sunni-Shia conflict? I think certainly. Is it on the far end of the extremist part of that Sunni piece? Absolutely. So it's even a threat to moderate Sunnis, not just the Shia population. So clearly, it's an area where all of the world benefits in cooperating with each other. However, we shouldn't confuse cooperation on a single issue as a change in strategic direction.
We're talking to Major General Mike Jones, former Director of Operations and Chief of Staff for U.S. Central Command, and Amir Hanjani, who's a Truman National Security Fellow and an Iranian-American businessman. More from our conversation coming up after this break. This is Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Later, we'll hear from former Connecticut Congressman Gary Franks. But first, we're talking about Iran and the Iran deal with Major General Mike Jones. He's former Director of Operations and Chief of Staff for the U.S. Central Command, and Truman National Security Fellow Amir Hanjani. They were in town to speak at a World Affairs Council event. I guess I'm just wondering if the both of you can comment, though, on this idea of how these two countries can use this deal now that this deal seems to be in place as a way to actually build an alliance over something like the threat from ISIS. How do you, Amir, begin to build enough trust within these two countries to say, this is a threat that we both face, we might not be doing this for the same reasons, but now that we have this one question off the table, Iran's nuclear program, at least for a certain amount of time, can we work together to solve this issue right now, which is threatening quite clearly both of us?
I think that's exactly right. I mean, this removes a big piece of the puzzle off the table and allows for dialogue on other pieces of the puzzle. The Supreme Leader has signaled that although no broader rapprochement is in the offing, that the Iran will be open to talking about other issues. So I think the most obvious case is both, I think the General and I would agree, would be ISIS. That's the first thing that has to be tackled. It's a threat not only to Iran and the U.S., but a threat to the peace of the world, as we see with the refugee crisis going. I mean, states are now falling apart because of ISIS. As far as a broader rapprochement, I think that's a generational thing. There are many other issues, as the general has pointed out, that need to be put on the table for that to happen over many years. But you know, you have to start with the first step. This is the first step.
What are the other issues in your mind, General?
Obviously, their designs on the region in terms of destabilizing other countries, trying to exert more than just influence in other parts, and to just expand their domain as kind of a follow-on to this Iranian Revolution idea. I think that's a big issue, and it manifests itself in lots of different ways. Terrorism is one way. The kind of interference that they do, the sponsorship of third parties that go out and do nefarious activities. And then there's a whole range of things, I think, that have to be addressed. The question is, does this agreement get you there? And the answer to that question is, first of all, unknowable. You know, we have no idea. Anything that we think about the Iranian regime is just guesswork because we just don't know the inner workings. And so it could go that direction. I mean, it's possible. Anything is possible. On the other hand, it's just as possible. It's a North Korean scenario where they successfully execute a covert program. They end up with a nuclear weapon. And then they don't feel like there are any limits on their adventurism in the region.
Does that seem likely, given what is in this deal, that they would actually be able to covertly create nuclear weaponry under the thumb of this this inspection regime?
Well, I think yes. As I look at the agreement and what's in the inspection regime, it allows us to monitor and inspect the places that we know about or that they declare. I don't have a high level of confidence given that the program has been covert and everything that they've admitted to so far is stuff that we already knew and they know we knew. I don't have a high level of confidence that they're going to fully disclose, and I think the inspection regime is insufficient to go out and find areas that are not disclosed. And I think our intelligence community, as much as I respect our intelligence community and the hardworking people in it, it's just not practical to think that they're going to be able to ferret out all the elements of the program. And you can go back just as sure as we are today in many of these professionals that this is going to work and that they've ended their program and we know where everything is. You know, a lot of the same experts were just as sure that there was WMD in Iraq. Turned out not to be true.
First of all, you never know what you don't know. If there is suspicion of, per this agreement, if there's suspicion of creeping out or sneaking out of a covert program and Iran doesn't report it, the IAEA and the inspectors can ask to look at the site. And as far as the general's comments about intelligence, well, we've had pretty good intelligence on the Iran nuclear program to kill or as reports are out there, six Iranian nuclear scientists to launch cyber attacks, Stuxnet, which severely degraded their nuclear program. So we're going to have more eyes and ears there now than we have today. And big parts of their program, such as their highly enriched uranium, 97% of it's going to go out of the country. Iraq, which was designed to be a plutonium reactor, is going to be redesigned so it no longer produces plutonium. They're not allowed to conduct high-level testing of advanced centrifuges. Their centrifuges are going to be cut from 19,000 to 6,000. The only people that can stop Iran from developing a nuclear weapon is Iran. They've mastered the enrichment cycle. They did it under our nose for the last 25 years. They ramped up their centrifuges. Quantitatively, every time we put on more sanctions, they kept marching ahead with their program. So as far as what the general proposes, as I guess this anytime, anywhere inspection, that's an illusion. That doesn't exist. No sovereign state would allow other states to come and look at everything that they have. It doesn't work. And this happened with Iraq for a time. And for that time, Saddam kept saying, you know, playing around with the inspectors and we were running around and they were always in the penalty box. When in fact, they didn't have anything. Iran doesn't want to prolong that situation the way the Iraqis did.
Well, I agree 100% with Amir that any time, anywhere inspections are probably not practical and would not be something that's acceptable. But as I said, I think you have to have sufficient capability to be able to go look at those sites. And the adjudication process is not just the IAEA goes to them and says, hey, there's a suspicious site and we need to get in there and so forth. If the Iranians refuse, then it goes to an adjudication. and it requires a majority of vote on the Security Council in order to be able to then force an inspection or declare that they're noncompliant. So it's a little bit more complicated than that. But this business of saying if there is a suspicious site that the IAEA can immediately go to it and see what's being evacuated out of that site during this 24-day process, that their movement is not going to be inhibited, I think is absolutely reasonable. And on the intelligence side, when I was in uniform, I was watching that intelligence. I know a lot about how we gained the intelligence and what it was and how we know what we know. And I would tell you that, you know, we can't talk about all that and the methods and sources and all that kind of business. But I think what we can say is that no professional would be able to say that they guarantee that we know everything about their program. It's just not practical. And you have to have some kind of verifiable procedures to balance what you don't know in that intelligence side in order for this to work.
We have just a couple of minutes, and I want to get to just a few other quick items. And one really is, from your perspective, Amir, what don't we understand about the country of Iran here in the United States? What is it that we don't get?
I think the biggest misconception is that all Iranians are anti-American and want to burn the U.S. flag and bomb Israel. I think that's just was never thus. By and large, the Iranian people are very pro-Western. They want engagement with the outside world. They have no interest in starting a war with Israel or the United States. The rhetoric of the government, while at times can be repugnant, actually they're quite cautious and quite calculating in how they exercise their power. They are a rational state actor. They are not irrational. They're not suicidal. They may say death to Israel, death to the United States, but are they going to start a war with Israel and the United States? No, because that would risk them being totally annihilated.
If their people largely look to the West, why does the rhetoric continue? Why must the rhetoric always be front and center in what the rest of the world hears? Because that rhetoric is indeed what I think a lot of people turn to when they say, we cannot trust these folks as actors in this region because just listen to what they say. They want a nuclear weapon because they want to destroy Israel.
Well, they've said, actually, from the Supreme Leader on down, that we don't want a nuclear weapon. They've said that now for 11 years. And the Supreme Leader has signed a fatwa, which is a religious edict in Iran, saying we don't want a nuclear weapon. That's binding. I think Iran is certainly a PR problem in the West. It's of their own making.
Fair to say.
Yeah, it's of their own making. However, there is a disconnect between their rhetoric in some ways and their actions. They're quite cautious. They're quite calculating. They're a rational state actor that looks after its interests. I mean, let's take Iraq. The U.S. and Iran were cooperating after 9/11 against the Taliban. It was only after President Bush got up there and said acts of evil, and there was talk in the Bush administration that Iran is next, that they kicked off their nefarious activities, both in Afghanistan and Iraq. That's what a rational state would do. If you're in danger of being bombed and being pushed out of power, you know, you act to protect yourself. And unfortunately, they did that in very nefarious ways. So I think this notion that Iran is a messianic, suicidal regime because, you know, if you see them on TV burning American flags and a few thousand people chanting death to America is wrong. It's more nuanced and more complicated than that.
Well, I'm getting less confident in my trust of Iran because I don't know whether I should trust what they say or not. You know, on one hand, they say we don't want a nuclear weapon. But at the same time, they have an enrichment program for which there would be no other reason to have it than a nuclear weapon. They have a weapons development program to build the bomb itself. And they have a ballistic missile program. So should I believe that they don't want one? On the other hand, should I disbelieve the fact that they want to destroy Israel or they want to, you know, do all the other kinds of things that they're doing? And I just argue with the fact that this began because of U.S. activities in 2003. Iran has been in conflict with the United States, to include violent conflict with the U.S., for a long time, long before the U.S. invasion of either Afghanistan or Iraq. So this is a continuance of kind of the direction of the regime, not a change that occurred suddenly. And the last thing is there was a time when they halted some of their activities in terms of this program. After 2003, and we have to presume it had something to do with the number of U.S. troops on both sides of their borders that might have had something to do with that. And then finally, because of the sanctions that are in place, both of those have caused a modification of some of their activities regarding this program, not all the other things that we've seen them do. So I'm confused as to whether or not we should trust the Iranians to honor this agreement and trust their word or not. And if we do trust their word about this agreement, why we shouldn't trust their word about what their strategic objectives are.
Well, I don't think you should take their word for it. The agreement provides for a mechanism. It's distrust and verify. You know, we're sending an unprecedented number of inspectors in there to verify what they've done. And look no further than the interim agreement that Iran signed 2 years ago. There was the same calls and same rhetoric coming from those who were against that deal, saying Iran's never going to do this. They're never going to stop their highly enriched uranium above 20%. They're not going to let those highly enriched uranium kilograms go out of the country. And the IAEA came in there and within a few months said they lived up to their agreements. And the U.S. OFAC and the State Department said yes. And there was very limited sanctions relief. I say, don't listen to their rhetoric. Listen to their actions.
And it is an interesting discussion. Major General Mike Jones, retired U.S. Army, former Director of Operations and Chief of Staff for the U.S. Central Command. Thank you very much for joining us. I appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Thanks to Amir Hanjani, who's a Truman National Security Fellow, also an Iranian-American businessman and Middle East expert. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you. I'd like to thank the General as well.
And this program helped out by the World Affairs Council of Connecticut, who brought these two gentlemen in to speak. They're also speaking at Central Connecticut State University. Thanks to our friend Ned Lamond for putting this together here on Where We Live. Coming up next, we'll hear from former U.S. Congressman Gary Franks. He's releasing a new book this winter called With God, For God, and For Country, Because We Can Do Better. I'm John Dankosky. This is Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Gary Franks became the first black Republican elected to the U.S. Congress in nearly 60 years when he took office back in 1991. Since his political career ended in the late 1990s, he hasn't been heard from in Connecticut. But now he's got a new book coming out this winter called With God, For God, and For Country, Because We Can Do Better. He's also forming a think tank and a super PAC with plans to get more African Americans involved in the political system as Republicans. He lives in Maryland now, and he came by our studios late last month. As you'll hear, because his book isn't out yet, he didn't want to give out too many details of his plan. Congressman Gary Franks, welcome to Where We Live. Thanks for joining us.
Good to be on your show, John.
Let's talk first of all about you, because you've got a lot of ideas that you want to talk about in a new book that's coming out. But one of the things that I have to ask you is, after you left Congress and after you you tried to run for Senate against Christopher Dodd back in the late 1990s, you kind of stepped away from politics and you kind of stepped away from the state. Where'd you go?
Well, most people under the age of 95, I think Bob Dole is under that age, and even though Bob Dole is under that age, he's in Washington as well.
Yeah.
Most of us would stay in the Washington, D.C. area to do public policy type work, et cetera. I became an adjunct professor at Georgetown University did that for about 10 years, and been a professor at Hampton University for about 12 years. That's where I've been, but my home is Waterbury, Connecticut, and my family's still here, and I visit here frequently.
Look, when we or anybody else who might have asked the question, whatever happened to Gary Franks, goes on Google, you find a newspaper article that starts like this. After losing a Senate bid in 1998, Franks withdrew from his hometown of Waterbury, Connecticut. I'm sure you've read it, but I'm going to read it because our listeners might not have seen it. Leaving a discreet trail of foreclosures, betrayed friends, and debts exceeding $100,000 in three states. Some of these debts are quite personal, such as a $35,000 loan from his childhood friend or medical bills from the hospital that he credits with saving his life. His debtors have tried to track him down, but public records show that he and his wife, Donna, used variations of their legal names that make it almost impossible to follow his paper trail. I'm sure that you
Can
have...
Can I interrupt you,
yes,
John?
Yes, please.
Because most of those things are lies. I have had my same name all my life. I have lived at my same residence for 12 years. I have visited and lived, had a place in Florida and for a year or so. But I've had a situation, very unique situation, John. When I was in politics, I had well over $1 million, maybe multi-million dollars worth of rental properties. Yeah. A third of them were burned down during the time in which I was in office. Literally burned down by people who hated my guts. So, John, I've had experiences where the Ku Klux Klan has actually attacked my family. I've had instances where the Black Caucus has done things to me. And I've had instances where my sister passed away And she died in a very mysterious way. We ended up suing that hospital. And that hospital has taken it upon itself to retaliate in this manner through working through this one or two newspapers to spread these stories that are just so fictitious and just so libelous and so hateful. So I just pray for them, John. Yeah. I just pray for them.
And again, obviously, from my standpoint, from anybody's standpoint in the media, we don't like to read things that are not true. I wasn't here. I don't know what's true and what's not true. But aside from that story, I haven't seen very much. I haven't seen very much from you. I haven't seen very much from you refuting any of these allegations. I haven't seen much from you in the press. I guess I'm just wondering
when I ran for office, yeah. I never dignified any type of attack toward me. Some people may remember when my opponent had animals running across the screen and saying that Gary Franks is this. Or some people said that this person died, and because of Gary Franks' vote, they would have been alive. I never responded to any negative attacks. And also, I know that people who hate that much, I just pray for them, John. I've seen them too many times, and I pray for them and wish them well.
And I'll just ask you one last follow-up question on this. Do you face debts in your life right now that you're trying to pay off?
I'm like any other American, John. I've been very, very blessed, and I thank God for my blessings and my children, and we move forward.
I want to talk about a new book that you're putting out very soon. And when I was looking at your website to get some more information about what's coming up in this book, which is called With God, For God, and For Country, Because We Can Do Better. At the top of your webpage, it says, "Let's work together to end the war on God." What does that mean to you?
There's been a turnaround, John, going back to the 1960s when we first started to have a major erosion in this area. Started with school prayer, then started with even taking away a moment of silence in school. And so we've had those types of erosions. And I think that it's hurt our country. Prior to, we had the Connecticut Blue Laws when you didn't have a lot of commerce being done on a Sunday. During that time and prior to that time, I should say, we never lost a war. And since that time, we've seen a major erosion where if you look at even our last two presidents prior to Obama, where decisions have been made that have really led to the detriment of our country. Mm-hmm. During Bill Clinton's time, you had the period of the banks going wild, and that almost led to our economic collapse. And then obviously 9/11 and weapons of mass destruction and no weapons of mass destruction, and we're in a war for 15 years. So I think that even today, even when you look at this slow erosion towards saying thank you to God, we shouldn't be out at the mall on Thanksgiving Day. It was never like that before, John. We allowed that day to be a day in which we would say thank you to God and spend time with God.
That's very important to me. Politics is too, and
hopefully we get to that.
But as you look at the top of your site,
God, For God, and For Country is coming out probably around the first of the year.
So obviously,
and thank you for talking about
God in God's place in your life and in the country is very, very important to you. And I think a question that a lot of people would have is, maybe we have turned away from a traditional Christian God on Sundays. In a lot of ways. But your God isn't everyone's God.
No, I'm not saying a Christian. You said that, John.
I said
God. And once again, the Ten Commandments, Muslims follow, Jewish people follow, and Sulu Christians. So it's not, I'm not looking just at the Christian side of it. I'm looking at the Ten Commandments and looking at history. When Pharaoh, who followed pagans, went up against Moses, what happened? He lost. When the American Indians confronted the Europeans who came over, one followed pagans, one followed one God, who won? So, I mean, there's so many examples.
Well, I think a lot of people would call that a genocide, the massive destruction of Native Americans in the country.
I'm just saying who won, John. We're talking about winning and losing. So when you look at the situations in which, people who have followed the Ten Commandments, and I think we have in the past, but I think that we're slowly eroding, going away from that. I mean, just yesterday, John, I think there was a problem with a display of a Christian symbol in a school. So I think that, the Establishment Clause is there. It's in the Constitution is there, but obviously, it's something that I feel very strongly about. That is the adherence of the Ten Commandments.
But I think that's really the point. You mentioned, for instance, the display of a Christian symbol in a school, in a public school.
religious symbol.
Well, you said a Christian.
I'm sorry, you actually just said a Christian symbol. I think it was a Christian symbol in this case.
And so a lot of people who aren't Christians may be indeed offended or hurt that either they are forced to confront this as a teaching, or that in any way their tax dollars would go to support a Christian symbol being put at the forefront of a public school, when maybe they're Muslims, maybe they're Jewish, maybe they're agnostic, maybe they're atheist. And so the question of God is an important one, and there's a distinction between different people.
John, that's just my personal opinion. I'm not here to impress anyone. I am here to tell you how the Republican Party can get 25% of the black vote in the 2016 election, and how we in Connecticut can start to win elections statewide, because we can start to do better in New Haven, start to do better in Hartford, start to do better in Bridgeport. And I tell you, I have a plan for that.
And I want to talk about this, but let's jump off, though, from the title of your book, and let's jump off from the thing we were just talking about. How does God play into that? How does God play into getting more blacks involved in politics, getting more Republicans into politics? How does it help you accomplish some of what you're looking to do?
It doesn't. It's two different topics.
There's two different things.
Yeah. One part of the book is with God, for God, and for country. So it's three different topics.
I just want to make sure I understand.
I know you didn't get an advanced copy.
I haven't seen an advanced copy of the book.
I do apologize.
No, that's okay.
There's no correlation between the two.
Okay.
But they're equally as important. You also notice my website, which people hopefully will go to, which is GaryFranks.org.
You can
see about the super PAC activity as well, because we have to, as Republicans, do better in a lot of our urban areas. And the Gulf is so wide you can drive a truck through it. Because let's talk about that. Look at some of the practical things, John. Dr. Martin Luther King and others, they wanted us to, as black people, to be involved in the entire political process, not just voting, but the entire political process. Back in the 60s, you didn't know what party Martin Luther King was part of. You didn't know what party that many of the leaders during that time were part of. And yet we had the greatest growth from a civil rights perspective during that time than any other time. Now, today it's quite different. It's quite different. And I look back at history, and you see how in 1877, the same thing was true. Most everybody was Republicans who were black. After that election, which ended up going to the person who got fewer votes, that being Rutherford Hayes, well, it was followed by Jim Crow and 5,000 lynchings. Well, today you have just the opposite. 90%+ of blacks voted one way. Mm-hmm. And today you have literally thousands of deaths going on in the black community every single year. So whether there's a correlation there or not, it's as far as all being in one side. I told you before the show that it's like going to a basketball gym with 10 guys. If you say, let's play a pickup game of basketball and nine guys get on one team, you can't play. You can't participate in the game. And just getting back to my earlier point, if you only have 50% participation in the political system, that being only with the Democrat Party, how can you expect to get a passing grade? How can you expect the system to work for you
from an accountability perspective,
from a number of perspectives? But also—
Another piece of that, though, I think is in terms of African-Americans being involved in the electoral process—
mm-hmm.
Many African Americans in many communities across the country have seen that Republican Party politics have attempted to, in many ways, keep them away from the ballot box, whether or not it's voter ID laws, whether or not it's attempting to make claims that there is more voter fraud in America than indeed there is. Do you think in some ways the Republican Party has not reached out to the African American vote quite the same way as maybe has pushed them away from the polls, because so many of the GOP politicians know that people are going to vote Democratic?
Well, two things. One, let's look at the record.
Yeah.
And the civil rights bills in the 60s, a higher percentage of Republicans voted for those bills in the House and in the Senate than Democrats. That's the record. Let's look at the record. Affirmative action was started and teeth was placed into that bill by a Republican, Richard Nixon. Martin Luther King's birthday was signed into law by a Republican, Ronald Reagan. School segregation was fought hard by Eisenhower and others, but the method to get desegregated schools were Republican ideas, school choice, magnet schools, et cetera. So there's a lot of issues. And getting back to the voting side of it, 1 point more blacks voted in the last election, percentage-wise, than white people. 1.7 million more blacks voted in 12 than they did in the historic election of 2008. So in the state of North Carolina—
I don't have those numbers off. I don't have those numbers off.
I can get them to you.
Okay.
More blacks voted in North Carolina than white people, just in raw numbers. So the historic nature of blacks voting at high levels is so ironic.
So why do so many African-Americans—
Let me get to the other point. Why do they vote Democratic? The other point is, if you have to fight for the vote, and I'm going to tell you how we can do that. The other point is, there is, John, voter fraud. I've experienced it. I've probably benefited in some elections, and I know I've been hurt in certain elections. I even participated in the understanding of how it's done, John. So I know that for a fact that dead people have voted.
Okay? How much?
John, I can tell you off the record, how it's done, and it's in my book. Here's what they got to do first, John. If you don't purge the list, in that same story you cited, they had me on the voting rolls for 14 years after I left Connecticut. So that's why you have to purge the list of voters, at least on a regular basis, so that if a person that you may know has died or a person that you may know has moved, you can't have John Doakes come in and vote for him. Because if you don't have any type of photo ID, some type of identification of the voter in some shape, form, or fashion, or purging the list, you can have a lot of interesting people voting in an election.
Is voter fraud really a bigger problem in America than voter suppression?
Because, John, I just told you that more blacks voted percentage-wise in 12 than white people, okay? Now, in an off-election year, it's the apathy, John, because in Hartford and New Haven and in some of these districts, blacks do not see how it would make a difference. Now, look, let's for example.
Sure.
When you see how schools are more segregated today than possibly after the post Brown versus Board of Education decision, when you see that black housing segregation is also extremely high, and when you see that justice was not done in my eyes with Mr. Zimmerman, I sat in the White House. I went to the White House when George Bush, number one, was dealing with the Rodney King situation with other black leaders from around the country. And I saw George Bush look at me and look at others in that room and said, we're going to go after these police officers, these individuals, on civil rights violations. And guess what happened, John? They did. So when you have a situation where our Justice Department says we're going to look into it, and nothing happens. Usually when the Justice Department, rightly or wrongly, when they look into certain situations, usually there's an indictment. About 80% of the time, if they announce that they're investigating, usually it's an indictment. Well, we haven't had any other than what's happened in the Charleston situation, which is so obvious was a civil rights violation.
There's a lot to talk about there, and you brought up George Zimmerman. You brought up Rodney King.
Yes.
Let me bring up everything that has happened since Ferguson, Missouri, around this time last year. Mm-hmm. There have been a series of police shootings and other instances in which mostly white police officers have engaged with mostly African-American individuals. I think we can all agree far too many people have ended up dead. Far too many people have ended up angry and upset and feeling as though they are not being properly represented, they're not being properly protected. In your plan, what do you do about that, Gary Franks? What can we do better than we have done in this last year regarding police and the way they interact with African Americans?
I start, John, by in some instances, you can look at. I'm going to tie it into racism. I can't answer that question, John, but I'm going to take it to another point because I have this in my blog, which is GaryFranksBlog.wordpress, and I talk about racists are taught. And really, the theme of it is against Dylann Roof. They're taught. Racism, you're not born a racist. You're taught to be a racist. Now, how are you taught to be a racist? Mm-hmm. You're taught to be a racist when you look at an employee who's next in line for that promotion, who happens to be a black individual, and everybody in the office knows that this black person should get the job. And then you, as the white person, says, no, we're not going to fill the position. When you have people who don't intermingle with each other because of our certain things that are happening in our society, a polarization in Congress, a polarization in so many places, that officers and people react differently when they see someone that's different from them. Now, I grew up in a very diverse area. I was fortunate enough to go to a great high school, the state champs in Connecticut, that being Sacred Heart High School. Got a plug for Sacred Heart. fortunate to go to Yale University, another great institution. And I was in diverse environments. I worked for three Fortune 500 type companies for 10 years. But John, I know that there's race. I saw racism when I was 9 years old, 10 years old. I had a cross burn in front of my yard when I was a youngster. Had a dead possum placed in my mailbox when I was a youngster, and I went out there and I pulled that dead possum out of the mailbox, dripping in blood. Fast forward. When I was a sitting congressman, I went to a certain town in my district, and I looked and I saw people draped in white, in a white uniform with things on their heads. I had my chief of staff go over to the organizer of that parade and say, I'm not marching in this parade if they're marching in that parade. You think you know who I'm talking about.
Mm-hmm.
And the organizer of that parade, I'm a congressman in the 90s, walked over to me and said, I guess you're not walking in the parade. I'm a U.S. congressman.
Mm-hmm.
First black Republican in 60 years. First black House of Representative member in all of New England in the history of the region.
Well, what it sounds so like you're saying, yeah,
so my
yeah,
point
yeah.
is, we want to rid ourselves of racism wherever we can. I can't answer the question about the police officers. My only response to that is that we have some people are not intermingling as much as they could and should, and then they have a better understanding and appreciation for each other. And that's why community policing has worked so well in so many other communities.
But if part of what you're saying is that blacks in America have to have greater political participation. One of the issues we hear over and over again is it's hard to feel as though you're empowered to take part in politics if you are being judged by the people who are supposed to protect you differently than other people are being judged, right? Yeah. It's just that if your neighborhoods are being policed differently, if cops are looking for the types of low-level activity in your neighborhood that they wouldn't be looking for in the suburbs, you begin over time to think, my goodness, there's nothing I can do. That's a lack of power right there. And doesn't that have to start somewhere in terms of the way we work with police to not view African-American communities like that?
John, we need more jobs in the black community. We need to have a situation where people are not so segregated in certain areas. But the bottom line of it is, John, for many African-Americans, they're swimmers and they're drowning. And the first thing that anyone should do when they see a person drowning is what? Help them. And that's what the black community needs immediately. And I wish the president would do that immediately.
So what does the help, what does the help look like? Because the Democrats
I have some specific ideas, John. Not to be shared with you today, because as I said before, it's part of what will become of the think tank, and we're going to work on massaging these ideas. And I promise you that when we have them well fine tuned,
this is one of the most important issues we're talking about. I mean, essentially, what Republicans say almost across the board is that Democrats hand you something, and that's the problem with Democrats. We want you to be empowered to work yourself to do something for yourself, right? So you're talking about helping the black community. What do we do,
John? As I said before, I'm going to refrain from answering that. I do have some answers in my book. However, the think tank is going to work on these ideas. We are going to work with other think tanks. We are going to also sit down and talk to politicians. I know that dialogue is important. When we worked on the welfare reform bill, we heard from a number of think tanks and got input from other folks before it was fine-tuned.
Yeah.
And that's what I intend to do with this.
That's former Connecticut Congressman Gary Franks. His book out this winter is called With God, For God, and For Country, Because We Can Do Better. He promised to come back and share some details of his plan that he couldn't yet divulge. Our program is produced by Lydia Brown, Tucker Ives, Betsy Kaplan, and Josh Nalea. Our technical producer is Kyone Wolf. Our digital editor is Heather Brandon. The executive producer of Where We Live is Katie Talarski. I'm John Dankosky. This is Where We Live.